welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it.
My guest today is Malcolm Penn, the founder of and CEO of Future Horizons. Welcome back to the podcast, Malcolm.
Thanks, Dan.
Please refresh our memories on what Future Horizon does and how long you've been at it.
Okay, sure. We're an industry analyst, so basically we keep track of the industry, the trends, the technology, the markets, the development, the numbers, and we try to then interpret that to analyze what it means to the industry. And that's kind of what our base mechanism is. We've been doing it since 1989, so this is our 33rd year. And before that, I set up DataQuest in Europe, set up the European operations here. And before that, worked with ITT Semiconductors in a variety of roles there. So I've been doing the industry for over 50-odd years, and I've actually lived through every downturn except the very first one. So it's been an interesting ride.
Yeah, you know, this is the third podcast we've done together, and we've spent a lot of time together. We're good friends. You know, it's just interesting. I don't always agree with you, but you have some very insightful views. So let's get started. Malcolm, you've spoken about the cyclical nature of the industry, right? We all know that. How do you respond to the school of thought that says we're nearing the end of growth, the doomsayers, the economic growth cannot be sustained forever, and that companies will have to focus on optimizing their business rather than growing it?
Yeah, well, I think we're a long, long way from that. I mean, you only have to look around to see how the industry still keeps spreading laterally into not just taking the areas that it's already in and growing those vertically. It's growing into new markets and new areas all the time. And every time we kind of invent something, it creates the next platform to build upon that and to expand it and invent the next phase of that. So whether it's a computer growing into artificial intelligence or robotics or all those kind of things. I mean, we just create these markets by making these new areas affordable and doable and realistic and practical. And every time you build a better microprocessor, you create a new market to analyze something you couldn't do before because it was not possible. So I really can't see us running out of steam in the industry for an awful long time to come. And when you look at the technology roadmap driving that, can we keep on inventing better parts, better products, cheaper products? Then, I mean, I was at a meeting last week, GSA meeting, and IMEC made a presentation there, and their roadmap goes out to 2036. So, I mean, we're not going to run out of technology steam. And if we don't run out of technology steam, we're not going to run out of markets to invent.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was at the same event that you mentioned, GSA. I was at the Silicon Valley event. You were at the European one. I guess it was in Germany, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. I actually wrote about it, and I have some more blogs to come. But everybody was very upbeat. And one thing that was mentioned, and that I think it's an example of what you're speaking of, is AI. There was a lot of talk about AI, and they talked about ethics and stuff. But, I mean, if you look at it, Malcolm, AI is a driver that you mentioned. You know, we figured out something new, AI, and we're applying it to different markets, which is automotive is a good example, right? And, yep. You know, this is something where silicon wasn't really, you know, prevalent in cars, you know, in the years before. And now, you know, silicon is a huge part of automotive and AI is a huge part of automotive. And AI requires new die, new process, you know, bigger dies. You know, AI will never have enough power, right? You always will want more power. And, you know, and there's many more examples, but, you know, huge growth drivers that I don't see an end to.
Yeah, power and memory. I mean, it's just inexhaustible supply. I mean, or demand, not supply. So that's great.
Right. So 20 years ago, supply chain and poor management of inventory caused many painful issues when the downturn hit. And, you know, you would think we would learn as we go. But now, you know, that supply chain inventory capacity were so well tuned, you know, the industry was not prepared for the increase in end market demand and certainly not prepared for COVID. You know, I don't know how we could have been, but what is the middle ground and what should companies do? You know, are we doomed to repeat these cycles over and over?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, I'm a pure convict that the cyclicality of the industry is fundamental, and I'm not sure there's any absolute solution to it because the fundamental cause of the cyclicality is the mismatch between the supply and the demand dynamics. And the demand dynamics can be very, very quick to change, depending on the market and all sorts of other things, whereas the supply side is on a very much longer time scale. You're talking a minimum 2 years to bring new supply on board. So one's on a very long lead time and one's on a very short time. And to try to balance those two to get a perfect ongoing supply and demand situation is, I don't think it's practical to do that. It's just so we have to learn to live with it. Now, we didn't do a very good job in the early days because the supply side was driven by the industry forecasting what its customers wanted, what it expected its customers to want 2 years down the road. And of course, they always got it wrong. And in general, they always overestimated what was needed. So we tended to work in an oversupply situation, which was great for the customers, but not very good for the suppliers. And that changed a few years ago, primarily when TSMC adopted their "we don't build speculative capacity" mantra, and that turned it into a much more of a order on demand basis. And that again won't work because the customers don't really know what they want. So we're always going to underestimate what demand we want. And now we're running in a generally undersupply situation mode with very little capacity in place for just in case or unforced cast supply. So somehow we've got to find a middle ground in there, which I think involves the industry talking much more closely with each other and sharing the risk. Because on the one side, it was the semiconductor industry that took all the risk, and now it's the customers that are taking the risk, and neither side wants to pay for that. But in general, I don't think they can not. That risk has got to be shared. And what I believe the industry needs to work much closer towards is a very much more cooperative model of putting capacity in place, recognizing that you won't get it right, that you will ideally want to have slightly more capacity than you want rather than slightly under capacity so that we can keep this market fueled. But that would involve both parties sharing the risk. And I don't see that really happening yet as a general rule. It happens to a certain extent in some rare instances, but in general terms, we've not really developed this true partnership, sharing of risk, sharing of reward type of relationship in the industry.
Yeah, I agree. But my experience, I've been in the industry for 40 years, not quite as many years as you have, but 40 years. And one of the things that I really appreciate is that the semiconductor industry is full of incredibly smart people. When I talk to people outside of the industry in different industries, it just makes me realize how smart semiconductor people are. And we are problem solvers. I mean, that's what we do for a living. And so, you would think we would get smart and we would be able to solve these problems. And I think we are. For example, the automotive guys just got crushed because they could only use this one specific part for their cars. And when this one specific part was not available, they went into crash mode. But companies like Tesla, are more agile. They were able to go to different sources for different parts, for the same capability. And, I think companies like Tesla, have really led the way to help us better manage our supply chain and to help us be more agile.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that that's interesting because, Tesla wasn't a car company. So therefore, they didn't come with all the baggage and all of the hubris which the typical car industry comes from, which is a very mechanically driven industry by tradition. So I think that's kind of a disruption there, which the automobile industry is going to have to kind of address because they got to rebuild their whole 100 years of history and learn how to deal with computers on wheels rather than bits of metal on wheels.
Right. And I've seen this on SemiWiki is so many more car companies are joining our site. And Tesla was actually the first car company that joined us. And we talk about semiconductor design enablement, EDA, foundries, IP. So people who are reading SemiWiki are doing their own chips. And when Tesla came to me, I was a little bit surprised. I said, why are these guys on SemiWiki? And then I looked on LinkedIn and they had hired a bunch of semiconductor guys, a lot who I know. And, you know, they clearly were doing their own chips, and this was years ago. But now I'm seeing the other automotive companies doing the same thing. I mean, every car company and 100 plus that I've never even heard of are on SemiWiki. And that's going to change the industry. You know, so this is what they've learned, is that they have to control their silicon. And to do that, you have to design your own chips like Tesla. And so that's a huge change in our industry, and that's just going to be yet another boom for, you know, EDA, IP, and the semiconductor world, because everybody's going to be creating their own chips and adding more capability rather than just grabbing chips off the shelf.
Yeah, right. So that comes back to your very first question about, are we running out of growth? And the answer is no, because now you've got all of these OEM companies going direct to the foundry, designing their own ICs. And they're the ones with the money. And when you look at the value chain, that's where the money is, at the system end of the market. It's not at the bottom end of the market in the IP and the chip part. So therefore, they can afford to do it. And they can therefore go back to the beginning, when you can tailor make the chips to your system to make them really sing perfectly, to get the optimum performance out of your product. And so those will be the differentiating factors in the future for the car industry and all other industries, in that, you know, we're going back to the chip is driving the performance rather than just simply using off-the-shelf jelly bean parts, which everybody has the same kind of performance.
Right, right. And the cloud guys are doing the same thing. And the interesting thing is, I've worked on a couple chip projects with the cloud guys, and they approach chips differently. I mean, they spend a huge amount of money on tools, and they have all the compute resources that you could ever want. And, you know, friends of mine who moved over to working for the cloud guys, designing chips, they are just in wonder, because now they can do as many simulations as they want, rather than saying, okay, I only have one computer for one day. I can only do, 1,000 simulations. I got to make this work. And so you're going to get different types of chips, and you're going to get much more capability and much more, possibilities for, the end product. So that's also driving our industry. And that's a big change.
Yeah, it's chip designers' heaven these days, because, they're not constrained by the limited resources that a chip company can throw at it. When we do one kind of calculation, which shows that the traditional chip companies get on average $9 a square centimeter. Whereas when you look at the system end of the market, these guys can get $450 per square centimeter in revenues. So they can afford to do things in duplicate. They can afford to do three things in parallel and pick the best one that works. So it's really going to drive the chip industry into new horizons, where we can see an acceleration of performance, not limited now by R&D budgets, and in the same way as they are if you're doing it within your own chip company.
Yeah, it's never been a more exciting time in the semiconductor industry, and that's just one of the examples why. So, Malcolm, many people believe that price increases, some of which are still in the pipeline, and LTAs, which are, long-term agreements, wafer agreements, for example, will reduce volatility of demand and lessen the impact of any potential softening in demand. Do you agree that this might indeed make a difference?
I'd like to hope so, but in reality, I think at the end of the day, yes, it's good to have these agreements in place, because in the past, they've been far too laissez-faire, and there hasn't really been a commitment. Customers will place orders and cancel them willy-nilly and leave their suppliers up the river there. That's not fair. That's not right. But I think on the other hand, when you look at it from a practical point of view, if for some reason your customer doesn't need the product or no longer wants that product because maybe the market's turned down a little bit there, or he's got too much inventory and he needs to liquidate it, if he doesn't need the parts, maybe legally you can force him to take the parts because of the agreement, but he's not going to love you for that. In fact, he'll probably hate you for it. And the fact remains is, if he doesn't need them, it's very hard to actually force him to take them. And so I think at the end of the day, there's going to be a great deal of compromise on this here, because if you do force him to take them, all you're going to do is push the problem down the road and probably lose a customer at the same time. So I think pragmatism will have a very tempering effect on these long-term price agreements. And as for pricing, the thing about pricing is, in Wally's recent book, the one you talked about recently, The Predicting Semiconductor Business Trends, that is an awesome book. There's so many super charts in there that Wally's pulled together. And one of them, there's two in there. One is that the silicon revenue per area is constant, and the other one is what he called Gordon Moore's second law, the one no one talks about, which basically says IC ASPs eventually approach $1. That's something that we've also believed in. I didn't know that it was Gordon's second law, but I'm pleased to see it is, because it just means to say that we've got prices now which are 30% higher than their historical trend line. That can't last. So those prices, whether it's a price increase, the first thing that happens if the market turns down and orders start to become difficult, the first thing that happens is in the DNA of the industry, they'll cut the price to get any order. Any order is a good order when you've got no orders on hand.
You know, with the foundries, which is what I mostly work with, you know, they have wafer agreements, and there are outs on wafer agreements. The foundries will not force you to take wafers, but you know, it costs you money, pricing, right? So you've signed up for a specific quantity of wafers, and you get a specific price. And if you order less, then it's going to be more price. So, you know, they don't actually force them to take the wafers, but it does, there is a financial penalty. And so people, you know, more than likely will take wafers. And based on the conversations I've had and what I've listened to on conference calls and such, is that customer inventories are at an all-time high. And, you know, I'm not saying that's because TSMC is urging people to take wafers, but people are building inventory that they haven't had in the past based on the shortages. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, just in case versus just in time, which is, you know, terminology that we use quite a bit now. But the reality is, customers have inventory that they hadn't had in the past. And at some point in time, they're going to get comfortable with the supply chain. And, you know, we're going to be able to reassure people that they can get these products on time. And, you know, what's going to happen to those inventories, Malcolm?
Well, I mean, in classically, they get liquidated. Which, I mean, you've already bought the product that you need today, so you don't need it. So in past times, what happened is that the unit demand literally falls off a cliff because you liquidate your inventory, and then you only buy the top-up parts or the parts that you didn't have in inventory for whatever reason. So your unit demand goes from its very high level now, which is about 30% above the normal trend line where you would expect it to be at this point in time. That just gets liquidated, so you stop buying. I mean, it really is as straightforward as that. And I know that's being oversimplistic, but that's what happens in the holistic sense of the word. And if you got it in inventory and you don't, and the lead time is now down to 4 weeks or 6 weeks again, down from 40 weeks or 50 weeks, suddenly you've got 30 weeks worth of inventory and stock which you've got to eat up and use.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, there have been price increases, and you know, that's one way the foundries, you know, control demand, of course. But you know, as you said, if you're a systems company and your wafer price increases, it's really not that big of a deal because you're selling a whole system, you know, like Apple selling $1,000 phones. But if you're a fabless company, then that price increase, you know, does cut into your margins, which are much thinner. And so, you know, the system guys really, you know, are fueling this industry. I know they're more than 50% of TSMC's business and EDA business and IP business. But, you know, it's just an advantage when you're selling this system for, you know, $1,000 or thousands of dollars, you know, versus the fabless guys who are really thin on margin. So it's just a game changer, really. It's a different way the semiconductor industry is doing business now.
Yeah, and that will buffer certain of the trends, but it won't reverse them, I don't think, because at the end of the day, if the ASP increases hold, then that means that the average selling price, the average revenue will go up. And that never hasn't, I mean, it hasn't done that in the last 40 years or so since we've got statistics to measure this here. So, I mean, I think it could happen, of course. Everything can happen, but then you've got to think about, you know, if the prices go too high, then it's supply and demand. Demand will drop. It's a classic supply and demand equation. And so, you know, there's only a certain amount of checks and balances that you can deviate from in the short term, but over the long term, it tends to come back to the trend line there.
Yeah, I agree. I just think that the
true fabless companies that are just selling chips, they're going to be a little more constrained and their business is going to change. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, Broadcom, big chip seller, is now buying software companies, right? And so maybe Huck Tan, the CEO, sees things in the future that the fabless guys are going to get squeezed by these system guys.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way to move up the value chain. You know, you've got to move up the chain into the next level. So going from a chip company to a system structured company is a way of getting more money. Absolutely.
Yeah. So many semiconductor companies talk about the rise of manufacturing costs. Doesn't that put a limit on how low ASPs can drop, or will the drop in demand force a drop in costs down the chain?
I think this has been an issue that comes up regularly. You know, designs are too expensive, wafer prices are too expensive. The industry seems to be able to cope with that and compensate for it so that the overall averages don't actually change. It's remarkable. I mean, again, in Wally's book, the average trends in there and some of the charts that we've been publishing, those long-term averages have been incredibly robust. So when you kind of push somewhere else, it gives in another place there and the whole thing kind of balances itself. So there does seem to be a budget for every part of the food chain in there, and you can't really seem to deviate too much from that. Now, maybe if you did, it would be because there's a monopolistic situation. For example, Intel was able to charge a significantly higher price for their microprocessors for a long while, all the while they didn't really have any competition to beat the price down to where it ought to have been. But those days will last throughout the time when their heyday is there, but they don't last indefinitely. And eventually something comes in to either attract a new company to come in with a new solution, a new way of doing things, because if they see someone making so much money, then that opens the door to competition. And in this market, the competition is fierce and intense.
Yeah, the book you mentioned is called Predicting Semiconductor Business Trends by Dr. Walden Rhines. It's actually published by SemiWiki. You can get it on Amazon. So you can just search Walden Rhines or Predicting Semiconductor Business Trends. I have it on my desk. I've read it multiple times. You're right. It is a very valuable resource. Just one final question, Malcolm. What can a company do to try and soften its landing if and when a recession hits?
Well, I think what we always tell our clients is when you're in a boom, be prepared for it to end today. And when you're in a bust, the opposite, be prepared for it to end today. Whatever part of the cycle you're in, you've got to be prepared for the next part of that cycle. It's kind of a bit paranoid in a way, but I think, you know, you've got to be in there. You've got to have the plan already written, because if you've got your plan already written, then you just walk in, and when the whole thing goes wrong, you press the button and put the plan into process. You don't have to think about it. You take away that thinking time. And certainly when the market changes, whether it's up or down, the companies that reacted the fastest are the ones which feel the less pain and survive that change in a much more positive way. So fast reaction, be prepared. And hope you don't need it. Okay, fine. I mean, it's good to have a plan that you don't need, but it's awful not to have a plan when you do need it.
Right. That's always been my business strategy. Prepare for the worst, hope for the best. So you won't be surprised. Yeah. So just the final, I'm going to hit you up for some numbers. What were your numbers last year, Malcolm? Just remind us.
Our number for 2022 was 10%.
No, I mean 21. What was it for last year?
For last year, it was 18 with an upside of 24.
And we actually did 26, right?
Yeah, and I was branded as being over optimistic at that point in time when we came out with that forecast.
Yeah, you were the closest one for sure. So
no, I'm being too pessimistic. And this time I hope that I am wrong. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So this year, what are your numbers?
I just reduced it to 6. It could still be 10, but I think it's going to go. Start to go wrong in the back end of this year, which will affect the fourth quarter.
Wow, 6, that's a low number. You know, I track the foundries, and they are still booming. And you know, the May sales report for UMC, and UMC and TSMC, you know, have a similar cadence. They were up 42% year over year in May, and January through May they're up 37%. And so TSMC has similar numbers. We'll hear from them shortly. But 6%, I don't know. You know, somebody asked me to bet the over under, and the number was 10%. Would be over it or under it? And I bet the over. And I still think we are going to be over. I at the beginning of the year I said 15%. I think maybe it'll be, you know, closer to 10%. But I still think we're going to have a pretty good year.
Yeah, well, I mean, the year-on-year WSE numbers were also just out, and they don't show that same kind of double-digit level growth numbers. It's still a double-digit, but much lower. If your order books are full and it looks good, that's fine, but that can change overnight if things start to go horribly wrong. And what worries me is we're now facing this tsunami of a very much worsening economic outlook, particularly as we move towards the end of the year with the squeeze on concession discretionary spending, high inflation rates, coupled with capacity just about starting to rear its ugly head of coming on stream, new capacity. And that's a nasty combination of having a slowdown, even a slowdown in demand with a rising capacity is not a nice combination to have. And that's what worries me. I think 2022 is really in the bag. And whether it's 6 or 10% is to my mind, just a timing difference there. And what worries me is what's going to happen in 2023.
So what's your feeling for 2023? What's your number?
I'm going to ask you to cover your ears for this because our forecast is negative, minus 22%.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm waiting for the brickbats to come back on that one. But I mean, I can't see any other direction.
Yeah, you know, I feel it'll be back to single digits. I mean, we're a single digit industry. That's what we've done most of my career. You know, if you average out the boom and the bust, and but you know, I still see high indicators. You know, EDA and IP are still doing well, and that's the precursor, right? EDA is design starts, and IP is design starts. So I haven't seen a drop there yet, but it might be coming. So yeah, I agree. 2023 is going to be a challenging year. If there's an over under on 0%, you know, betting on positive or negative, I would definitely bet positive. But you're right, things could go really bad in a hurry. You know, if the world climate doesn't change.
Yeah, no, they do. And the averages, I agree, is 8%. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But unfortunately, the average can be spanned by a plus 40 and a minus 30. So, and we do get these violent changes. I looked at over the last of, I don't know, 30 or so years of the high to the low. And those range anywhere from 20s, low 20s, up to 60, 70% differential change. So my coming from a plus 6 to minus 22 is a 28 percentage points change. That's actually quite benign when you look at some of the changes that's happened in the past.
That's true. That's very true. Well, we're about out of time. Thank you again, Malcolm, for spending time with us on the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. This is your third trip. We will definitely do a fourth at the end of the year, and we'll see who's wrong and who's right, and hopefully we can get a better picture of 2023.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for inviting me again. Appreciate it.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.